Each Saturday night, lovers of jazz tune into WVIA to listen to Sasha Feinstein's program, Jazz Standards. Since 2007, Sasha has been bringing insight with apt and often witty commentary on a single subject matter or artist in jazz. Fans of Sasha Feinstein and Jazz Standards have the opportunity to experience Sasha's wit and insight on two other topics, his poetry and the mixed challenges of dealing with the wreckage of the loss of his father. When on Monday, April the 24th, Sasha will be presenting his poetry and creative non-fiction at an upcoming reading at the James V. Brown Library in downtown Williamsport. The reading, which is free and open to the public, will be held in the Lowry Room of the James V. Brown Library, beginning at 6 p.m. Sasha took time from his schedule to chat to me recently about his work wreckage at the WVIA Williamsport studio.
This is my 11th book. It's my second memoir. The first one, which was called Black Pearls, was largely about my mother. This one is primarily about my father. They're very, very different people, and they're very, very different books. With my mother, she died when I was quite young, and I thought that those memories had simply been erased. And when they came back, then I realized I had a book, and it was going to be based on that kind of unrecovered memory. My father lived much longer. He died in 2003, and he was a sensational painter. He really was incredibly gifted and also a tremendous teacher. Very, very inspiring, and one of, I guess, the most focused artists in any field that I've ever known. But he was also a hoarder of monumental proportions, and so sometimes those two overlapped a bit. They would come together in the still lifes that he would create for his students. Sometimes he would bring things from the outside and make sculptures or staircases or what have you. But they were largely up against one another in the sense that one was incredibly creative and the other side being incredibly destructive. And by the time the summer house, which passed down to me, got into my hands, it was pretty much ruined. And the process of trying to save that home, really coming to terms with the unbelievable amount of wreckage that he had accumulated, started me thinking that, once again, I have this kind of polarity to work with as a writer.
You're a very creative person yourself. You're a phenomenal writer, as well as a musician. And yet, I've been in your house. You're not a hoarder. What is it, do you think, that triggered in the mind of your father that created this need to hoard?
Well, you know, Fiona, I've also not taken you to certain areas of the house where I have, in fact, large collections of things. But I do consider those to be collections, like book collections, music collections. And those are things that, you know, when we talk about collections, have some kind of value. In terms of hoarding, it was never the actual value of the pieces that my father collected. And in fact, he collected mainly uncollectible objects. Anything that was ruined, anything that was destroyed, anything, in other words, that needed him to give it value. And he loved the fact that he was the one giving it value, that there was possibility in everything that he brought back, but it was endless, and it just took up tremendous amounts of space. I went through maybe 30 tons of material in that summer house alone. None of it was worthwhile. Every now and then, I mean, once in every ton or so, you would find something worth saving. Most dramatically, a painting that he did and stored away beneath rat poison and all sorts of things that I found, unearthed, and have now framed it, and it looks gorgeous. You know, so everything did have to go through my hands. But what also went through my hands was just an unimaginable amount of rubble and wreckage and the like.
Were there any clues, do you think, in his past, in his childhood, that created this need to rescue things that were not loved?
I don't know. You know, he was born in 1915, and he and his family came to the States from the Ukraine, they left in 1919 and they arrived in 1921. And I always thought that there would have to be some kind of connection between immigrants and the need to collect and to hoard. The reading that I've done says no, but I cannot help but think that, you know, if you're that young and you're on a journey to the States and halfway through all the currency changes and your family has nothing and they make it to the States and then they get hit with the Great Depression and they lose everything all over again, I cannot help but think that that has some kind of deep influence on somebody, especially when these things out there are free. They can be obtained. But his brothers, they were not like this. His mother, to a certain degree, had some tendency like that, but it was very much an individual aspect of my father's life.
Hoarding is a strange, it seems to be a modern, Western problem. It affects many, many people, varying education and varying backgrounds.
Absolutely. The bottom line is, when you see shows on TV like Hoarders, or you read up, you know, on the books on the subject, you see what a wide range of people it does affect. I have not come across people really close to my father in the sense that he really did have a spectacularly creative mind, and therefore it wasn't just holding on to it because he was afraid of letting go. He really wanted to keep the possibility of making something out of these artifacts, and often did. You know, the triumphs that he made sort of proved that this stuff was worth collecting. But, you know, he would pack bureaus solid, and when they were filled, then pack other bureaus and put them next to them, in front of them, on top of them. They just became like insulation of a sort, and it brought the houses down. It literally brought the houses down. There were cracks in the ceiling, the foundation was ruined, the Cape House had no septic. It had such a crazy wiring system that in order to turn on the dining room light, you had to turn on the electric stove. It was in chaos, absolute chaos.
The other side of this picture, though, is your father, the artist, your father, the incredible artist. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because this book isn't just about a hoarder. It's about your father, Sam, this amazing artist, and I've seen some of his work. Moving, incredible painter. Can you talk about that?
Well, that for me is what made the book worth making. It wasn't just, you know, I lived in a world of junk and this. What was fascinating was the fact that he could see the beautiful connections in shape and color and movement, and that these still lives, which to the layman would just look like a mass of chaos, were very carefully constructed so that students themselves could be guided through to see the connection in this shattered vase as it moved to that piece of plastic, as it moved into this piece of wood and that drop cloth and so on. And making these abstract paintings based on the still lives that had balance and verve and energy and that were exciting, but that were in fact based on this kind of potpourri of rubbish. And his own abstract expressionist paintings are as exciting and symphonic as any that I know. And granted, I'm biased, I'm, you know, his only child, but they are absolutely magnificent, and they give a kind of radiance that he would talk about as a teacher and as a practitioner of art, about how we had to make these four edges of the canvas into a symphonic whole, that they had to have what he called plasticity, a constant movement, a push and pull of color, that it was as orchestrated and focused as a symphony. There are things that he said in his teaching about movement and balance and the adjustment that one must make in order to create an organic whole that I use in my teaching of writing. I mean, it's just marginally translated from one art to the other. I learned so much as an artist just from listening to him as a kid and then as an adult and then, of course, from seeing the works themselves.
So his art informed your art?
Very much so. The idea, for example, that the edge of a canvas has so much more power than color or something in the center of it, that is the last moment, and that our eye emphasizes, let's say, an orange that suddenly touches the edge of a canvas. That's so true for lines in poetry. The line breaks, the stanza breaks. Those kinds of crossovers between the arts were tangible and made a lot of sense, and I often talk about them that way in the classroom.
Tell us about your father as a teacher. Where did he teach?
He was mainly self-employed. He had been in the Philadelphia Academy of Art, offered a position, a permanent position, as head of the art department. And this was ages, decades and decades ago, and he decided that academe would stifle him too much. You can imagine just the little that you know about him, how he would not necessarily yield too well with the rules of academe. So he said no, and he started teaching privately like his great mentor, Hans Hofmann. And he did that for half a century, teaching in New York, in his New York property in the basement a couple times a week, and on the Cape in the barn.
I should imagine for many artists, the discipline of the academic life can be a challenge.
How so, Fiona?
Well, it's always struck me that as an artist, you tend to be very independent-minded, and necessarily, in order to be a solid teacher, you have to conform to a certain amount, and I should imagine that a lot of artists find that tricky.
Yes, absolutely. And I misunderstood you at first. I thought you meant discipline in terms of the craft. And he was as disciplined as anybody I know in terms of really knowing his craft. And yeah, I've been talking about his abstract paintings, but he could do photographic portraiture with a Bic pen. I mean, he really had just tremendous skills. But in terms of this other, absolutely. He just didn't want to talk in committees, and he didn't want to, you know, push papers or do this kind of stuff. He wanted to be himself with nobody to kowtow to or to adjust for or any of that. You're dead on. He couldn't do it. He wouldn't have. They would have booted him out. I mean, as an academic myself, it's as good a gig as you can possibly get, really. You get a lot of time off to work on your art, and there's great stability, and you get to teach what you make. So for me, it's been beautiful, and I must say he was very pleased that I became a teacher and pleased that I could do those sorts of things that he refused to do.
Did he expect you or hope that you would become a painter, that you would become a visual artist?
I think he would have been as happy if I had become a plumber. He never pushed the arts. He always felt that it was a brutally difficult path to take, and always said he would be very happy if I had just fallen into something where you'd, you know, be an accountant or being something where you get, you know, steady money without having to deal with, you know, the art world. My mother, on the other hand, she very much wanted me to be an artist. She always felt that that was the greatest thing one could be because you kept growing as a human being. And I wouldn't call it the greatest thing you can be, but it certainly has been great for me.
You are very well known for your knowledge and passion for jazz. Did this come from your father? Did this come from your parents?
Indirectly, I would say indirectly. Like most, you know, young kids, I was listening to pop music at the time, and I didn't know much at all about jazz until my father and our great friend Thorpe Feit, another fantastic painter, introduced me to the music. And they didn't have to do more than put on a couple of records. It simply locked into my aesthetics. I loved it right from the start. So yes, it was my father who said, all right, let me show you that there was something before the Beatles. And that's when he put on Kid Ory and Coleman Hawkins and The Skies Opened.
I can imagine that it is difficult writing about your parents. There are all kinds of challenges that present themselves, that don't present themselves if you're writing about somebody that you vaguely knew or don't know.
To some degree, although I find it strangely easy just because you do know your parents so intimately, and in this case, since, you know, my dad's been gone for 14 years, you have a sense of time and a sense of balance. I could not have written this book the same way, at least, when he was alive, but I also hadn't dealt with what I had to deal with until after he had passed. The other thing I sort of reminded of when you say this is the poet Ed Hirsch, who said that he's always felt as a writer that the parents are fair game. The kids, not so much. The kids, he has trouble talking about because, you know, you brought them into the world. But, you're, you know, the parents, they brought you in. They get what they get.
So I take it that you're going to rely on your kids to write your memoir.
Well, at the very least, I'm going to do my very, very best not to leave them with the kind of baggage that was left for me.
Sasha Feinstein, PhD, co-director of Lycoming College's Creative Writing Department, talking about his upcoming reading at the James V. Brown Library in downtown Williamsport. The reading, which is free and open to the public, is to be held on Monday, April the 24th at 6 p.m. in the Lowry Room of the James V. Brown Library. To celebrate National Poetry Month, Sasha will read from his most recent poetry collection, Ajanta's Ledge, and his recently published memoir, Wreckage, My Father's Legacy of Art and Junk. Sasha Feinstein is a poet, essayist, and editor who has published 10 previous books. One of his poetry collections, Misterioso, won the Hayden Carruth Award. His other books include a memoir, Black Pearls, Improvisations on a Lost Year, an interview collection, Ask Me Now, Conversations on Jazz and Literature, and two books of critical essays. Sasha has received many academic honors, including the 2008 Pennsylvania Governor's Award for Artist of the Year. In 1996, Sasha founded Brilliant Corners, a journal of jazz and literature, which he still edits. Brilliant Corners remains the only literary journal in the country that focuses on jazz-related literature. Sasha Feinstein's reading is to be at the James V. Brown Library on Monday, April the 24th at 6 p.m. Thank you, Sasha.
And thank you, Fiona Powell. Fiona Powell is the producer of Jazz Standards, and what a team they are. We hope you'll tune in Saturday nights for Sasha Feinstein and Jazz Standards here on WVIA.